You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 59 of Own the Build with me, Paul Hemming. Today's episode, the title of it is quite interesting. I think it's something that I spent a lot of time pondering and trying to answer the question when I was a QS commercial manager back in the day. So it's, how do you prove delay on your construction project? And like I said, it was a task that on my last project that I worked on, actually, Battersea Power Station, it was a thankless task, to be honest with you, on that one. And it was a project where this topic is very close to my heart. It's a really difficult topic, so I'm pleased to welcome onto the show a genuine expert, Michael Downes, who is a solicitor / construction expert at Gordon's LLP, a law firm from Yorkshire. He's going to help us solve the question. So, welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. I'm feeling pretty good about this episode, apart from one nagging issue that I have in the back of my mind. So I know that you're in Yorkshire, Michael, but I know that you're not from Yorkshire originally, are you?
No, I'm originally from Birmingham. So
yeah, and North Birmingham as well, as I understand.
Absolutely, yeah. I was wondering how long it would be before you brought this up into the podcast, but I thought we'd get past a couple of minutes at least.
No, straight to it. So everyone, I don't talk about football often on this, and that's largely because I'm a Birmingham City fan, and we don't talk about football because we're Birmingham City fans. There's not much to brag about, but I've gone against everything that I stand for here by inviting onto the show an Aston Villa fan. Liam would be absolutely distraught with all this, as am I. But you bet this is going to be good, Michael, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, look, at the minute things are going well for us, so I'll leave it there and won't say too much. But yeah, it's brave for a Birmingham City fan to get an Aston Villa fan at this time, I think.
Here we are, though. So anyway, let's scrap the football to one side for the minute.
I think it's and for the best.
it definitely is from my side. Yeah. Let's talk about construction. Before we get into the topic of today's conversation, introduce us to yourself, what you do, and your experience, mate.
Yeah, well, I say you've already given me quite a kind intro there. I'm a construction solicitor working for Gordon's LLP. We're an all-service commercial law firm set in with two offices, one in Leeds, one in Bradford. And yeah, our role is to really service our construction clients, and that can be anything from employers to main contractors, subcontractors, to assist with any issues they can have in relation to setting up contracts, managing the contracts and the project as they're ongoing. And then, as is always the case, and probably what we're going to get into a little bit on this podcast, dealing with all of the problems and issues and disputes that happen, which typically happen towards the end of the project and when things get a little bit messy. And that tends to be where I kind of come into things a little bit more. My focus is a lot more on the dispute side of things and resolving those nasty problems that can typically crop up.
But I'm sure almost every single one of the listeners can pass their minds back to a project, to a contract, to a client that they worked with where things perhaps didn't quite go to plan, and with the best will in the world, ended up not necessarily in a legal dispute, whether it be adjudication, arbitration, whatever, but actually just in a position where there was a lot of friction, and then perhaps where there was more legal involvement. But tell me, Michael, I'm interested as to, obviously you trained in law. What was it that drew you to construction law and to the construction industry?
Well, to be honest with you, it's, you sort of go into the law because I did it as a degree and enjoyed it and enjoyed the sort of the work and the cases. And I think you always have a bit of an idea in your head as to broadly what kind of lawyer you want to be. I kind of kept my options open, really, and started my training contract and heavily got involved with quite a lot of just general dispute, commercial litigation, commercial dispute work. when I qualified within my previous firm. I qualified into their commercial litigation team. As a result of that, we managed to get a few disputes that were construction related, loosely related. It was mainly acting on behalf of subcontractors and you know, just general debt claims that have escalated into something a little bit more serious. And it just so happened I worked on a few of those, really, really enjoyed it, liked the sort of nitty-gritty of it and getting stuck in, and the kind of niche area of the world. It's sort of got its own dispute resolution mechanisms, and really, really enjoyed it. So when I joined Gordon's back in 2015, I sort of joined and went into their construction department. My previous firm didn't have a construction team. So I went in there to pretty much deal with construction disputes, and then kind of spans out to become the all-encompassing world of construction law.
And so you're a big fan of construction, are you?
Well, ever since from joining that and getting involved in it, it quickly became clear that I was never going to do anything else, and this is where I wanted my career to go. So yeah, I think you could say I'm a big fan of the construction side of things.
Excellent. I like that. We like big fans of the construction industry at Own the Build. We really do. Now, I ask every guest, some of them QSs, some of them property developers, architects, etc. You're the first construction lawyer that I have had on the show. And I want to ask you this question. What is the one common myth about your profession that you would like to debunk for us today?
Well,
is it that lawyers are all nice guys, that Villa fans, some of them can be all right?
Certainly, it's certainly not that, is it?
Definitely not.
It's got to be the common misconception, I'll say, that all lawyers are out there to take your money. They're expensive. They should be avoided at all costs, and are only there to send over those big bills. And I think that's probably the one, the biggest misconception about our industry. And I think, first of all, notwithstanding, you know, if you're getting a bill on your desk from a lawyer that you're not expecting, something's gone seriously wrong somewhere along the line, and you know, you need to be speaking to them. But I think it's more a case of, you know, the difference between just your standard lawyer and a really good lawyer that is worth its weight and worth the money is the ability to think commercially and work with you as a client, and you know, get to know your business, get to know the industry well. So the advice isn't just a case of it's straightforward legal advice; it's legal advice that's tailored to you as the company. And I think that's really where we try to aim ourselves. We see ourselves as commercial lawyers that get to know their clients. You know, we like face-to-face meetings. We like to sit down with clients and offer that extra bit of assistance and
arm around the shoulder and guidance, really.
Absolutely, and that's what it's all about. And I think that's probably the biggest misconception about good solicitors. You know, a good solicitor, you should be happy to pay that bill when it lands on the desk and feel that you've got a good value for money. Good service. Absolutely.
And so what I've understood, and we're just about to start the show, is clear. A good solicitor is not there just to pilfer money out of your pocket. They are value adders. Absolutely. We're still unsure about Villa fans because we didn't quite tackle that. Then we'll put that to one side. So
my normal advice would be steer clear of the Villa fans. You know, they clearly don't.
That's my advice as well.
Clearly something wrong with them. But
we've agreed on something there, Michael. Brilliant. We'll caption that. Avoid Villa fans. Anyway, let's get to the topic now, right? I've got to stop dwelling on this. But we are here today to talk about delay. I wondered actually this morning, aside from payments and disputes around being paid or not being paid, is delay the second biggest reason there's a construction dispute? I imagine payment is first. Is that wrong? Or
I mean, where the money is and people chasing money always tends to be the heart of what everybody wants to tends to dispute over. But yeah, I would say delay is one of the most common things that we would have come across our desk. And I would say that the reason it comes across our desk is probably the why we're talking about it today, and why and for some of the reasons we'll go into, is because it's such a problematic area, and it's sort of fraught with difficulties and issues and is often very, very hard to prove if you haven't got the right necessary things in place. And, you know, I mean, it's the very concept of delay is almost subjective anyway. It's kind of, you know, what has caused the delay is not necessarily black and white. And that's why there is always, or there's not very often, agreement over the cause of delay, the true cause of delay. And
well, there's two or three reasons why, and it's what is the prevailing reason, etc. But that's really
interesting.
Almost talking about the lack of clarity in the events. But one thing I think we can be black and white on is, what is the definition of delay? What is delay in a construction contract to you?
Well, I think delay, in essence, is the program hasn't gone as planned. It's somewhere along the line, something has happened that's prevented an activity or a sequence of activities from happening in the order or within the time that they should have done. Doesn't necessarily mean that the completion date is delayed, not always, but we'll come on to that. But it's, in effect, something along the way of the program has gone awry, which has means something has not been completed at the time that it should have done.
Because, again, and this is where you start to get into the complications and the nuance, right? So you're talking about, you mentioned there, a delay that might not impact the completion date, but it's a delay along the way, right? So I think what you're describing there is kind of the difference between delay and disruption, and then extensions of time, because extension of time being what would delay the end date, but delay and disruption is something that can impact you along the way, but perhaps doesn't impact the end date. But can we talk about that a little bit more, and you can explain it in a far more professional and brilliant way than I can.
Absolutely. Look, that, it's you're absolutely right. Look, it's in essence this whole question and this whole concept of time versus money. You know, you're if we touch upon extensions of time, extension of time is a mechanism within a contract, within a construction contract, where you've got to effectively demonstrate critical delay. Now, that is a delay to the completion date. So, you know, that is that's the type of events where something has happened that has had a knock-on effect or has prevented a critical event from happening within the sequence of the project.
So, for example, you mentioned critical delay, and critical being the salient word there, right? I'm going to go back to my experience. I was always in curtain walling and cladding, right? So a critical delay to us, as I would see it, is we need a concrete slab to be able to hang our curtain walling and facade on. If the concrete slab isn't handed over on day X, it's handed over 10 days later, that would be a critical delay to my completion date, I guess, right?
To the completion date of your works, absolutely. I mean, that's a great example. And those kinds of things are the kinds of things that you always typically see as events and activities that that are critical to the completion being completed on site. That's the critical element. It affects the completion of the subcontractor's works, or if we're looking at the project as a whole, the completion of the main contractor's.
And a critical delay is something that I can claim an extension of time for.
Exactly. Provided, and this is where it sort of comes to the second
part.
Here we go. Provided you can demonstrate that you, if we're talking about us as the contractor in this scenario, provided you can demonstrate that the cause of the critical delay is not the fault of the contractor and is covered by the contract between the parties as a cause of delay that they're entitles them to an extension of time.
So going back to my example.
Yeah.
So again, this is, I'm actually the subcontractor in this example. There is a main contractor. The main contractor is due to provide me with the concrete slab on the 1st of January.
Yeah.
For the sake of the discussion. They provide it on the 10th of January. Obviously, the 1st of January, I have no control over the concrete slab. That is someone else's works. So that would be a critical delay, because there's nothing I can do to foresee that, right?
Exactly. In that scenario, you've been prevented from your client being provided with materials that you need and are critical for you to be able to carry out the works that you need to do. You cannot progress those works. And say if your works are going to take 10 days, they're 10 days from when you have that concrete. So if you don't get the concrete until the 10th of January, you've had 9 days delay there. You know, it's still going to take you 10 days to do the work. It means it's going to be finished on the 20th of January instead of the 11th of January. I think that's the maths, isn't it?
Okay. yeah. Just about we got there. But okay, so this is really, I think this would be resonating, right? So I want to think about, I want to put critical delay and extensions of time into one box that we've dealt with. And then, so delay and disruption, that would be non-critical delay, or is there another?
Well, exactly. I mean, delay and disruption under the JCT, you often see it as loss and expense. It's the costs of a delay. Now, the JCT works in a way where I think it's good to use the JCT as an example. It's always one that as a template contract.
It's the staple, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And the way that works, it deals with two things: relevant events and relevant matters. If a relevant event occurs, it can lead to you getting an extension of time, which is what we've just talked about. If a relevant matter occurs, that can lead to you getting loss and expense, i.e. your delay and disruption costs. Now, it doesn't necessarily need to be that that something has occurred that has caused the completion date to push back and would entitle you to an extension of time. It's just, this is something where something has happened in the course of the project that has caused disruption to the contractor's works that has entitled them by virtue of the contractual provisions to be paid for for that disruption. So that's those kinds of delays. So it doesn't necessarily need to be then that is, you know, that pushes back the, you don't need to demonstrate that that's going to push back the completion date. You need to demonstrate there that there has been some disruption to your works that has caused you a loss.
So I'm trying to think of an example then, going back to almost the one that we were just talking about with the critical delay, just so you can picture it almost. So let's say that the concrete slab was handed over to me on the 1st of January, but the reality was that there was a few backprops still in place, which meant that for us to finish our works, it didn't take 9 days. It took 10 days because it was a bit more awkward for us to get our panels through, let's say. I know it's a bit of a technical thing to picture, but where it didn't delay us grossly, but it did just impact the way that we were working and made it, instead of 10 days, took 11 days.
If that was through a fault of the employer, that because it's taken longer than you would had originally planned, then that specific scenario would still potentially get you an extension of time, albeit it's a much shorter extension of time. A delay and disruption claim where it hasn't necessarily caused the delay to the completion date would be something, I don't know, say if you are using the similar example, maybe for you to fit the cladding, they provided you with some platforms, or they agreed to provide some platforms for you. You get there on day one, and or just before you're about to start, and these platforms aren't there. They're not going to be available to you, meaning you have to go away, source these platforms, spend money on some of your own platforms, and you then have to get a few more men on site to do the job a little bit quicker than you ordinarily would have done, but you still finish by the 10th of January. There's no delay to your works there, but it's probably cost you an extra 10% of your the amount that you would have ordinarily charged, because you've had some additional costs on the way. That's the disruption to your works that has resulted in an additional loss to you that you would be entitled to claim, provided the contract works in your favour.
It is. You have to admit, Michael, even just talking about it now, and I've had a lot of experience in it, albeit not recently. I obviously haven't been on projects personally for 5 or 6 years now, but it's something I spent a huge amount of time dealing with. Even just talking about it now, that it is, this is why we need lawyers and experts to kind of debunk it to some degree, because it isn't simple, and there's a lot of jargon, a lot of phraseology which isn't commonly used on site in project offices that people need to better understand in order to be able to manage their contracts and reduce their risk, right?
Well, it's exactly that. And look, they're complicated. They are complicated, these contracts. You know, we're dealing with usually big projects, often tens of millions of pounds. You know, a lot of people think they know the crux of it, and new additions come out. on most projects, these contracts are amended via a schedule of amendments at the that are
agreed. That is double the length of the original.
Fronts. Absolutely, and
because of you guys, changing
yeah,
them.
Because we're dipping in and complicating matters. That's what it is. Yeah.
But getting started.
But yeah, I mean the crux of it is, it isn't uncommon for people to, you know, that have been working with these contracts for years and years and years to, when you get down to these particular issues, particularly delay issues, and particularly if they haven't been involved with real delay problems before, you know, need the handholding a little bit through the process and how it works, what you can claim, what you can't, when you need to put a notice in, when you don't, you know, and that's ultimately what we do and how we help out. So you can do that sort of as it happens, but we try to sort of encourage our clients to work with them a little bit, sort of at the much, much earlier stage, usually hopefully during the contract formation as well, to kind of work with them as to and tell them and sort of get the practices in place so that they're best suited to deal with these things.
They actually execute it as planned. And that segues us onto the exact question I want to ask you after this break. Hello, it's me again. I wanted to share a quick story with you on why I co-founded Sealink with my best mate Chris. Chris and I, we're both QSs, and this is going to sound sad, but one night we were sat in the pub talking about subcontract tendering and we realised the industry had a problem. Number one, procurement was too paper-based. Number two, it was too time-consuming and every QS had their own unique way of doing things. And number three, perhaps most importantly, if you want to competitively tender, you need to know hundreds of the best subcontractors. We simply didn't. That's why we created Sealink. It's software to solve subcontract tendering. We wanted to remove these challenges and help the industry get better. So if you, or someone you know, tenders with subcontractors, you've got to see our software. Head over to our link, www.get.c-link.com/podcast, to find out more. I will include it in the description box, so again, there's no excuses. Now, let's get right back to the show. Michael. We've talked about what you want, and we haven't talked about what you want, but we have talked about the foundations of delay in construction. Pun intended, I'm going to take that. But as a lawyer, as a construction lawyer, you must constantly have clients reach out to you, say, this has happened on my job. There's been a delay. I've been completely screwed over by the client, and this has happened and that has happened. And you've said, can you go on, let's have a look at the documents then. And you have a look at the documents, and I imagine you probably go, what on? You don't say this, but you must be pulling your hair out thinking, why isn't this recorded?
You don't want it to be one of those situations, but unfortunately, sometimes that happens, you know, and you're thinking, right, this is going to be a bit of a battle, this one.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what I want to kind of extract in the next stage of our conversation is, what to you is the perfect pack of information on the topic of delay? A client comes to you and says, a delay has happened. What do you need to see? What do you want to see, I guess?
Well, we talk about a pack of information. If we're talking about the perfect pack, I think, first of all, it'd be great if all of the information was in a nice, neat, zipped folder, labeled up in little sections and all of that. I mean, I'm probably clutching at straws a little bit there, but within that imaginary zip folder of documents, I would think there's probably several sort of headline things that you would love to see provided to you from a client. If we're talking about a contractor has come to you with a delay that they've experienced on site, and they've put this to their employer, and their employer's had a look at it, the contract administrator's had a look at it, and it's been knocked back for one reason or another. What would we want to see? Now, it would vary depending on the type of delay, but very, very broadly, first of all, the first thing that you want to see there is the full contract. Now, you would usually think, well, that's straightforward. You know, you're gonna that's just a case of just sending that over. But you know, it's particularly on smaller projects as well, and everybody's very, very good at getting the work. You know, construction industry are brilliant at sort of networking, getting those jobs. But you know, you can from time to time find that certain things just aren't pieced together properly within the contract, and there can be problems, you know, in terms of what is exactly being incorporated into this contract. What are we required to do? Which can have a knock-on effect on being able to claim delay, particularly if, you know, you think you're not required to do something, but actually when you look at the contract, that there is an obligation to do something that you've that you're saying it could potentially be a relevant event. So you'd want to see a full completed contract executed there, absolutely. Then I think you would want, and this is where it comes into specifically with delay claims, a program. Or I say not necessarily a program, maybe a number of programs.
The contract program you'd need, right?
You want what we always call, or what you would say is, a baseline program. Sort of, this is what the agreed sort of steps that should have been taken. And if everything went perfectly and there was no problems on site, which I'm yet to encounter one of those situations, that's how it would be done. That's how it would be completed. That's what the starting point. How do we measure delay? You look at a baseline program. Ideally, that baseline program would then be updated throughout the course of the project regularly. So as works are ongoing and as particular activities are being completed, we're tracking when those activities are actually taking place. And so that really forms what you would then call the as-built program, the program that demonstrates how things have actually turned out. And you only get that if you do properly update that as you go through the job. You know, that's probably the one thing that you see more than not, is that the program hasn't been updated. You know, again, it's an administrative task that's a pain for any contractors or subcontractors or anybody to really do, to properly manage that. You know, and the real focus on the ground,
it requires discipline.
Exactly. And the real focus on the ground is always, let's just get the job done. That's the, you know, that's everybody's number one sort of aim on these projects. And it only really comes into play when something goes wrong, where you want to actually look at how things have developed. So it does, you know, it understandably gets forgotten. And then you would want probably to see an impacted program, which is demonstrating how the delayed event that you're complaining about has impacts the remaining work still left to complete. So, you know, if we are looking at an instance where it's an extension of time, you can see how the completion date is being pushed back and how one activity is affecting the next. So so programs are really, really key and important in delay claims, and that's kind of, in an ideal world, what you'd want to see there. I think it then comes on to the notices.
Crikey, guys, there's more. These lawyers, they Absolutely. Want everything.
You asked me for my perfect pack of
information. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, your notices. There's obviously a requirement within most standard construction contracts. You know, JCT and NEC contracts both provide for early notification of any event that you consider to be a delay event. So you'd like to see...
So just going back to my example, sorry to jump over there, because notices... They can come in many different guises, can't they? I'm going to take us back to my project where it's the 25th of December. I'm working on Christmas Day and I'm walking past the site and I'm thinking, I'm going to be starting the curtain wall on the 1st of January, but there is no concrete slab. What should I do? What does a notice look like?
In terms of what a notice looks like, there's not necessarily a prescribed format as to what
back of a
notice
packet
needs to look like. In essence, I mean, I've not seen that yet, but provided, I think it's more of what should a notice contain, and that is really, you know, because I mean, a lot of people kind of think sometimes we haven't given notice, you know, we did it retrospectively, and then you look through the email correspondence and you think, well, hang on a minute, you know. Your emails, and when you're
complaining
you're,
about it there,
yeah, the complaint, yeah. You're ticking all the boxes, you're saying all of the right things, and the contract only requires you to do that. So this could, in theory, be your notice. I mean, but what you like to see, and what we tend to work with, is putting together sort of prescribed forms of notices. That creates a bit of a discipline internally to ensure that, look, if we ever
which can include
you want to give notification if we're looking at talking about a delay event that's that you think is causing an extension of time, the JCT requires it to be written and given a early notification as soon as you become reasonably aware that the completion date is going to be pushed back.
So in my example, would I just say to them, I'm a week in advance, takes a week or two to pour a slab, would I just walk past the site and then go, right, I'm going to go home, go to the office, write an email saying, hello, it looks like the concrete slab is not going to be ready for a start date on the 1st of January as per our program. We therefore think there may be a delay. We'll keep you updated depending on when you hand it over to us.
Well, exactly. You want to be getting as much information in there as possible. So JCTs, we're going back to that. They require, if you also think that is going to cause you cost and disruption or loss and expense, there's also a requirement within the JCT to give early notification of what you believe that cost would be. So what you want to be saying is that the earliest opportunity, and I always say, look, it's not a case of there being a singular notice of that's the key notice that kind of triggers the ability to claim loss and expense and claim an extension of time. You want to be all over it, really. You want to be notifying them as quickly as possible, obviously, that this is an event that's going to be causing us delay. This is going to cost us money. It might even be the case you don't know fully how much money that's going to be, but as soon as you then become...
It's going to be difficult.
Exactly. Yeah. As soon as you become aware, you want to be telling them again. If you think that the delay is pushed back even further, you want to be telling them again. And it's the more that you're doing that and the more information you're giving to the employer, the better protected you're going to be moving forward in terms of, look, we've done all we can here to kind of push this.
We were always telling you that slab was going to cause a delay. I mean, they know it most of the time anyway. This is a frustration, right, I think, with a lot of construction people is you think, well, it's obvious if you don't give curtain wall contractor the slab, he's not going to be able to continue. So why the need for the notice? But that's what the contracts say, isn't it? And that's what, in your perfect pack, you want to see. Well, it said we were going to get it on the 1st of January. You didn't get it. Did you tell them? Did you tell them it was going to cost money?
Exactly.
And that's I think that is sometimes the penny drop moment for some people, is that it's almost just, these are things that you have to do as a matter of fact if you want to get the money. It's not overly complicated to do it. It's just habitual, isn't it? It's creating that habit.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's not uncommon for construction contracts to add more onerous provisions on what exactly notices
when the lawyers get their hands on them.
You know, sometimes exactly, and sometimes it has to be sent to certain individuals, not just the contract administrator. Sometimes the employer as well. Sometimes there's good reason for that. It could be that, you know, there's an obligation that the employer has in a development agreement where, and they'll want similar provisions down the chain so they can meet their requirements up the chain. And, you know, so there's various reasons behind why that might get added in, which is why I think it's always critical to, at the start of any project, to have a full contract review to know exactly what your requirements are for whatever situation may arise and when you've got to do
100%. It. 100%. Yeah, it's we used to do a contract audit where we'd sit down as a team and say, look, on this project, there are 10 key handover dates when we need to get the concrete slab handed over to us that will then trigger our program. We need to know those dates off by heart and be informing when we're not hitting them. If it's not our fault, we've got to tell them, because that's the only way we're going to cover ourselves. And that's what we did. And then we, on top of that, kind of built in a weekly report, which would kind of take a photo of each area.
Yeah,
and that photo would say this area isn't ready, which we kind of would use as a like a secondary notification or the regularity almost of informing that this hasn't happened. We need it to happen.
Well, that probably leads me quite nicely onto what was effectively the next item on, you know, what is it that you
sorry yes
to
yeah go on.
I mean, that's absolutely it. You bang on. It's the evidence of the particular delayed event that you're talking about. And that really is where it's, what exactly would you expect to see as evidence? Well, that depends. It, completely depends on the delayed event. What exactly is it that you're complaining about? But that can consist of records, site diaries, you know, updates, weekly updates, monthly updates, photographs on site, timesheets, all these things that can demonstrate that the actual delayed event that you're complaining about, one, has actually been caused, and it's been caused not by you but by the employer, if you're the contractor, but two, that the delayed event that you're actually complaining about has affected the progress of the works as well. And it's compiling that sort of evidence that's probably the most difficult thing. Emails are always straightforward. You know, they're great because they capture a point in time. If you get into the routine of writing this stuff down, sending an email whenever there's a particular issue on site, following it up, you know, to the contract administrator or whoever it may be, you're creating a nice little chronology and a nice little bank of contemporaneous evidence that can just be pulled and searched through when if it comes to a situation where it's gone legal, so to speak, and we're looking at it.
Yeah, no, but I'm guessing that I'm asking you, what is the perfect pack of information that you would get if it had hit the fan, so to speak, and you're getting called in at the end? But I'm guessing you're also advising clients at the start of contracts where they're getting into these challenging contracts, and you're saying,
absolutely, yeah,
what you need to do is always have your contract, have your baseline program, be aware of your baseline program, build an as-built program, an impacted program. Your notices need to go in looking like this, and you need to keep your evidence and store it all in one place so that you don't have to call me at the end of this job when it has all hit the fan, right? Because
absolutely. Well, that's the plan. That's the aim, really.
Yeah, because, you know, it's the last resort when you guys start to get involved, right? And often, if you're showing yourself regularly as someone who is diligently managing the contract, not necessarily in an aggressive way, just in the way that it tells you to manage it, right? And you're actually turning up to meetings with your client where you're saying, I've got my pack of information here, you know I have. More often than not, they're probably not going to want to get into a big fight with someone who's prepared, right? So I think it's a two-way street as well, isn't it? It helps you in the front end and at the end.
Absolutely, yeah. It's if you're doing those things, we get involved with our clients that we work with, main contractors. You know, they're brilliant at doing this, and we work with them to get these systems in place to make sure that we're capturing this information really without even having to necessarily think about it. You know, it becomes a part of how the project is managed. You capture this information. You're updating when works are being done, which is generating its own program and updating that as you're going along. You're, like you said, monthly updates, monthly reports, where photographs are capturing sort of how site progression is ongoing. Even if you don't think at that stage there isn't necessarily any delay, if you get into that process of doing that, when you look back at the evidence that's been built, you're creating a much stronger case in the event if something were to go wrong. And you're right in terms of the contractors that do that are much less attractive to go into formal litigation with or go into any real dispute resolution. They're the ones that you want to be settling the cases against. If whoever's got the evidence and whoever's in the stronger position is immediately in the driving seat.
And I wanted to, that kind of brings me on nicely to my next question, I guess, because I wanted to talk to you about prevention, really, and not getting into legal disputes, because you must be advising your clients on that as well. So how would you describe the best ways to avoid getting into disputes about delay?
It's exactly that, what we've just spoken about. It's the preparation, and I would always think everyone would say, well, of course you're going to say that, you're the lawyer, but getting the lawyer in at the earliest possibility, believe it or not, is probably the best way at saving legal costs. Because the earlier you get a lawyer in, particularly if it's during the project and during a particular problem, they can very, very quickly get things put in place to put you in a much better position. So it's, but I think in terms of prevention, it's for the best will in the world, you know, with the greatest planning litigation and disputes are a two-way street. You have no idea what your opposing number is going to want to do or how reasonable they're going to be. But you can certainly take steps throughout the project, do those things that we've just been speaking about to put yourself in the best possible position to avoid those unnecessary disputes. And I think just being commercial and being pragmatic as well, when you're in a situation where it hasn't necessarily gone well, it's opening your eyes to the risk and being pragmatic about where it's a battle you don't want to have, or it's a commercial relationship you don't want to lose, to start to think a little bit more sensibly about whether or not a dispute is really the route that you want to go down.
It's great if you put it into really simple terms, Michael. And I think for a lot of people listening, these will be things that they know in many cases, but also that they probably know that they're not doing as well as they could be doing because it's hard to build the habit, right? But if you're building the habit, around, here's the contract, what does the contract say about the program? Oh, that's the baseline program. Right, let's then make sure these are the key dates when we need to manage that program and we need to be aware of them. We need to be doing reports, site photos, whatever, and issuing our notices. All of a sudden, whether you're dealing with it commercially, ideally for the contractor, not for you maybe, Michael, but if you're then able to get through that delay commercially, that's brilliant. If not, and it goes to a legal dispute, let's say, then you're still in that really that better position of having all of your ducks in a row, right?
Yeah, exactly that. And look, I think it's easy for a lawyer to sit there and say, this is what we expect. We want to see this, we want to see that. And, you know, sitting at our desks and having not been on the ground and really seen how these, or being involved with how these things develop, you know, we're more than aware that no contractor, no employer, no project is going to achieve perfection on those sides of things. You're not. And you're never going to get that perfect pack of information where you tick every single box. But I think if you aim to tick as many of those boxes as you can and say, I don't know, if you achieve 80%, if a client comes to me with 80% of that, we're in a fantastic position. And I think that's the reality about it. It's balancing that need to actually do the job on the ground and, you know, work towards the number one priority, which is finishing the job and getting paid for it. And balancing that with the potential risk, which albeit may be small, of potential things that can go wrong. So we better have various systems in place to make sure that we're covering ourselves along the way. And it's making sure that you have those systems and you have those checks in place. If they become a very, you know, non-costly and routine part of the job, you're almost doing it as you're going along anyway.
Yeah. You talk a lot of sense, Michael, and I think, you know, I have to take it back what I said earlier about about you being a Villa fan. I can't take it back for all Villa fans, but you I'm willing to make an exception for.
That's very kind coming from a Birmingham City fan, I can tell you that. I don't normally get that kind of kind words from Blue Noses.
it's a one-time thing, but no, it's been really, really brilliant to have you on the show, Michael. I feel like
I've really enjoyed it.
There's loads of other things that we can cover and probably other interesting topics which are worth having a conversation around. So this may not be the last that you hear from Michael, everyone. And thank you so much for coming on the show, mate.
Absolutely, I'd love that. And yeah, really enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure.
So I will be putting Michael's details, his company's details in the podcast description. So feel free to get in touch with Michael. And for everybody listening, I'm going to be a bit of a nose now and just ask if you could give us a review and a rating on Apple. That would be brilliant. It's really good for the algorithm. Helps us to keep doing what we're doing. And I will be back next week. Michael, I know it's your birthday this weekend, mate. So have a good time, mate. And I will speak to you soon, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, Paul. We'll speak soon.